The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to Report from Asia. My name is Mike Consul, and our guest is Andrew Ballantyne, Head of Research in Australia for Jones Lang LaSalle. Mr. Ballantyne is the author of an article in a recent edition of Institutional Real Estate Asia Pacific that is headlined Measuring Liquidity. And the subhead reads, Assessing the Relative Liquidity of Australian CBD Office Markets. Andrew Ballantyne joins us right now by phone from Australia. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be part of the program.
It's good to have you. Let's start with a really basic question. Liquidity is really investor catechism. Why is that the case? Why the fixation with liquidity, especially in regard of what you're talking about with CBD real estate in Australia?
Sure, Mike. I mean, the main reason to me is quite simply that commercial property is generally considered to be an illiquid asset class. So for investors into the sector, the exit strategy is extremely important, and markets with low liquidity have greater risk around the ability to exit an investment.
How is liquidity effectively measured?
Look, in direct property, it's not very straightforward. We've grappled with it for a period of time around what is an effective measure for liquidity. Historically, transaction volumes are used in direct property as a proxy for liquidity. We feel that there are limitations with this as a method. So what we decided to do was ultimately construct our liquidity index, which utilizes transaction volumes on the numerator and the size of the investable universe on the denominator. And we believe that when you make an adjustment for the size of the investable universe, it provides an important understanding of what the relative level of liquidity is based on the size of the market rather than solely relying on transaction volumes.
So how does the liquidity of Australian commercial real estate fare vis-a-vis say, real estate in London or in New York or Tokyo?
That's a really good question, and that's going to be a large part of stage two of what we're looking to achieve. We've done some initial numbers when you look at that in terms of making an adjustment for the size of the investable universe, and we've typically found that Australia is the third most liquid real estate market in the world. However, we've only undertaken that analysis over a shorter 4 to 5 year time period, so extending that analysis out over a longer time period will provide us greater insight into the relative level of liquidity in Australia relative to those big markets in Western Europe and also the US as well.
So if Australia cities are third in the world, who's number one and number two?
Look, as I said, we've only just started to undertake the analysis and we need to look at it over a longer period of time. I haven't used the numbers from 2017, but it was actually coming up with the UK as number one, although I will expect, given the drop-off that we've seen in volumes, that will start to be challenged. And then you actually have smaller markets like Sweden tend to score quite highly on levels of liquidity just due to the size of the investable universe. So we believe that while there are certain limitations on what we're doing with our analysis, you need to look at it over longer periods of time and take a number of different views of liquidity rather than just looking at it through the prism of transaction volumes.
So you said who's number one at this point? I know it's very preliminary, but did you say the UT or the UK?
The UK, sorry.
UK, okay. Just, you know, the phone line, the accent, whatever. So
look, see with some of this stuff, Mike, it's because we've only started to do the provisional work. I probably feel less comfortable with going out and saying the UK is the most liquid because I know when I recount the numbers, it's probably going to drop down the ranking. So there's probably a second stage that we'd rather investigate before we go too definitively on what we see with our other geographies around the world.
So what is the utility of this ranking? What would an investor use that ranking for. You're saying here's the most liquid markets. Is that, well, I'll leave it at that. What's the utility of the ranking?
Well, the way I see the ranking is that if I look specifically at Australia, there has always been a perception around what markets have greater liquidity simply based on what market sees greater turnover. So part of the rationale for doing the exercise is that people would apply an illiquidity risk premium to smaller markets such as Adelaide. So I wanted to test that proposition. Is Adelaide a less liquid market? If I look solely at transaction volumes, I would come to that conclusion. When I adjust for the size of the investable universe, it actually shows that Adelaide is the second most liquid market when you account for that size. So I think it gives a good insight, or it challenges some of those perceptions that we have as analysts or investors around what markets are liquid and what markets are less liquid.
What facilitates liquidity in a central business district? If a particular city is more liquid with its real estate, why is that the case?
Simply, there's obviously a level of trading relative to its size. So you may see a market like Brisbane, which scored very highly on our liquidity index. As part of the strategy is that a number of investors look at Brisbane as a trading market, so they pick the right time to enter the market, they pick the right time to exit the market, and that in itself creates a level of liquidity in the market because you're seeing significant trading relative to the size of its market, whereas there would be other investors that would say Sydney and Melbourne are the cornerstone of my portfolio and I'm less likely to want to trade out of those assets. So while we think our index provides a more insightful measure of liquidity, we're very conscious of other factors that go into liquidity as well.
So your article looks at, or it looks to make an assessment of the liquidity levels across Australian central business district markets and also identify a number of implications for portfolio construction. So, and this kind of goes to the earlier question I was asking you, what is it investors and fund managers need to know in that regard when it comes to liquidity levels as you guys are measuring now? What are the implications for portfolio construction?
Sure. I think the main consideration for portfolio construction is looking at the level of the degree of correlation between the liquidity in certain markets. For example, if you're buying market A and it's highly correlated to market B, you will find that the liquidity windows are very similar. So what we found through this analysis is that a market like Canberra has very low levels of liquidity, of correlation in terms of its liquidity relative to the other markets. So we believe that investors should have a tactical allocation to markets like Canberra, where the liquidity correlation is lower, simply because they're creating liquidity windows across their portfolio. And ultimately, when they come to trade, and sometimes they're trading through a clearly defined exit strategy, sometimes they're looking to reduce leverage or gearing in the fund, and you actually want to have allocations to markets that have liquidity windows at different stages of the cycle.
Now, you also write that Australia benefits from two major investment themes: higher allocations to real assets and an increased weighting to Asia Pacific. So flesh that one out for us. You know, higher allocations to real assets, that's not necessarily just real estate. In the increased weighting, you're talking about increased weighting of real assets in a portfolio, I assume, and higher allocations to real assets, and the dominant real asset, I would imagine, is real estate in most portfolios. Is that, again, flesh that one out, Andrew.
Yeah, that's correct. What we've observed really running into the financial crisis and especially after the financial crisis is that a number of sovereign wealth fund and pension funds, in particular out of North America and Western Europe, have announced that they are increasing their target allocation to real assets. And as you correctly say, real estate is a very large component of that. So we believe that real estate is now accepted as a mainstream asset class, similar to equity and similar to fixed income. income. So firstly, there's just more capital being allocated to the sector, so that benefits real estate markets around the world. The second major beneficiary for Australia is simply being located in the Asia Pacific. As we know, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, Asia Pacific is expected to account for a larger proportion of economic growth, and a number of Western investors are seeking to have exposure to that growth story. The challenges when you come to Asia Pacific, however, is generally the lack of transparency. So we tend to find that core investors within the region tend to look very closely at Tokyo, and they tend to look very closely at Australia. So we receive a disproportionate amount of the capital that's allocated into this sector due to transparency and the availability of core product in Australia.
That really goes to my next question, which is, Australia just celebrated, amazingly, 26 consecutive years of GDP growth. It's the longest streak of annual GDP growth in recorded history. Meanwhile, the country is renowned for its the transparency of its real estate industry, as you alluded to. Is foreign cash flow into Australia, Australian real estate, on the rise? I think you've really kind of answered that question, but that being the case, what are the primary sources of cash flow from abroad into Australia?
Look, you're very correct that we have just recorded 26 consecutive years of growth. That does capture a lot of investor attention. I think there's always been a misconception that Australia is a hole in the ground and we dig things up. If you actually look at the composition of our economy, it's actually a very diverse economy. And if you were to apply a concentration ratio to Australia and look at the proportion of output that the top four sectors account for, it's significantly less than what you would see in the US as an illustration. So firstly, Australia is a very diverse economy, which is part of the explanation that we've had 26 consecutive years of GDP growth. I believe that offshore capital sources have become more familiar with the composition of the Australian economy and the growth drivers of our economy, which has given them a level of comfort in terms of making long-term investments into the Australian commercial property market. In terms of the sources of capital, before I answer that, it's probably worth looking at the proportion of assets that have been acquired by offshore capital sources. And within the office sector, it's been running at between 40 and 50% over the last 3 to 4 years. So that's significant participation from a diverse range of offshore capital sources. If we go back to 2012 and 2013, a lot of that capital was coming out of North America and Canada in particular. What we've seen as the cycle has matured is that we've seen new capital sources coming out, and we would say the most active capital sources in Australia at the moment are groups out of Singapore, groups out of Korea, groups out of Hong Kong, and also some groups out of Germany at the moment as well.
Now, you also say that fund managers should construct portfolios with liquidity windows. Now, I don't build portfolios for a living, Andrew, so give me a little, that's a little bit esoteric for a guy like me. Explain how a liquidity window would work. How would you actually build liquidity windows into a real estate portfolio?
Right. I think it's all part of how you construct a portfolio to me. And while we focused very heavily on liquidity in this article, to me it's just one ingredient that you use when you're constructing a portfolio. So if you're constructing a portfolio or a closed-end fund for a certain period, you would be looking at exposure to markets which have liquidity through cycles. To give you an illustration, a market like Perth in Australia, when that market is strong, you see very high levels of liquidity, and then you will find that it will have 2 years of very low liquidity. So if you're constructing a portfolio, you need to be cognizant of an investment in a market like Perth, where the liquidity windows can shut quite significantly. However, Perth is a market which tends to deliver quite high returns in an upturn, so you would clearly want to have exposure to that in your overall portfolio. So I think what a fund manager should do in terms of liquidity is make an assessment around each of the markets, look at how how their liquidity tracks through cycles, and then start to think, well, how do I construct this portfolio to make sure that I've got exposure in any type of market cycle, whether it be a strong market, a weaker market, to be able to actually trade out of my positions in those markets if I decide to do so.
Isn't this just yet another overlay for a portfolio manager to have to take into account and might actually take away from his or her concentration on some other factors that might be more critical?
Not necessarily. I believe that, you know, we have professional fund managers, and ultimately they are driven by doing the best for their unit holders or their investors into that fund. So I think the, you know, one of the benefits of, give my own profession a plug, one of the benefits of research is that we have more data on commercial property than we used to. Commercial property data was less transparent than, you know, broader equities or fixed income. So we've got more data, so we've got greater ability to do more analysis than we once were able to do. So I've been able to take some of that analysis and add it in. I don't necessarily think it's a significantly more onerous task to start considering liquidity, but it just provides a different insight into, you know, some of the considerations that you would undertake when you're making an investment or when you're actually constructing a portfolio.
What are the major bullet points that you would say a person needs to take into account based on your article when thinking in terms of real estate investment and liquidity?
One that I would think about is that we as human beings are all guilty of making assumptions based on our views or our perception. What I wanted to do with this article was actually challenge some of those accusations that certain markets in Australia were not as liquid as Sydney and Melbourne. That was really my basic premise for undertaking this research. And while I appreciate, as I've said on a number of occasions, there are limitations with our liquidity index that we're fully cognizant of, but it's actually just about as a fund manager, or as an investor, as an analyst, you continually have to challenge those inherent biases that you have as an individual. And you may look at the article and say, look, there's some really interesting points there. There's a number of areas which I believe there should be further investigation. But I think it's all about, well, to me, all research is largely about challenging your inherent biases. And thinking, if you do have those inherent biases, how do you actually adjust for, or how do you actually question a broader set of data or a broader set of assumptions?
And is there a specific bias that you think that this challenges?
There's probably a few that you would challenge. So you would think there's probably an element of familiarity bias. You tend to find that portfolio managers around the world sit within major cities, and cities that they have less exposure to, they obviously don't have the same depth of understanding of those cities, and they rely on their local resources. So there's an element of familiarity bias there. There's possibly an either recall bias that someone may have had an experience in a market which wasn't favorable to them, and they may say that I would be nervous about investing in that market again for any number of reasons. So I think there's a few different biases that you could potentially consider when you're looking at this type of analysis.